ladies and gentlemen. First of all, let me be probably about the 13th person to wish you a happy Columbus Day. And let me also outline what I think is the plan of the week. We have two lectures, today and Wednesday. What I'm hoping to do today is to finish our discussion of diversion and begin the materials on police. So that chapters 12 and 5 of A Century of Juvenile Justice are being covered. And the two B-space editions on policing which are the Bittner chapter and the recent Black chapter. And I think that'll march us through the week. Okay. Diversion. The distinction is between intervention theories of juvenile justice. That's supposed to make kids better. And diversion theories of juvenile justice, which is keeping kids away from the criminal justice system, but things are going to make them worse, and therefore allowing them to develop normally, not suffer from the processes in the criminal justice system, such as jail and criminal conviction and prison. And by keeping them away from those things, making sure that they can develop normally. The point I was trying to push home last Wednesday was the differential impact of the Supreme Court cases, Galt and Winship, on intervention and diversion as theories of juvenile justice. The point was that if the juvenile court was created principally as a method of intervention to treat kids, to make them better, and in that way to keep them from criminal careers, one would anticipate that giving kids lawyers and providing that they could not be convicted, adjudicated, remember we never use a word that's involved in the criminal system when we're talking about the juvenile system. So keeping them from being adjudicated for delinquency, unless the state can prove they did it beyond a reasonable doubt, well, that might hinder a juvenile justice system which was principally justified as a method of treatment and intervention . That was the point at which I was raising my voice last lecture by saying, wait a minute, is it really better that ten accused delinquents who in fact had committed the offense be acquitted? That is to say, 10 accused delinquents who need help don't get it, then it is that one accused delinquent didn't need help got assistance. Wouldn't that in fact be awful? And the distinction I was trying to make was between that and a system in which the principal value of the juvenile court as opposed to the criminal court was diversion. Because if the real reason that we pushed people into juvenile courts rather than criminal courts was to keep them from the harm of the criminal system, and the real value of the juvenile court was keeping them from that harm. Well, under those circumstances, giving them a defense attorney and providing that they also couldn't be adjudicated delinquent unless there was proof beyond a reasonable doubt, wouldn't hurt him much if the principal function of the juvenile court was to divert them from the harms of the criminal court, because we'd already done that. We'd succeeded in doing that, whether or not they're delinquent, whether or not they're adjudicated in the juvenile court, because they're not going to go to jail, and they're not going to be locked up, and they're not going to be harmed. Whatever the burden of proof is in the juvenile system, because we kept them away from the criminal system. So the distinction is important. Because making things harder for adjudication of delinquency is irrelevant if the reason for diversion into the juvenile system was to protect from the harms of the criminal system. That's as far as we got last time. And it was to distinguish that if intervention was the reason for the creation of juvenile justice, creating proof beyond a reasonable doubt as the standard in the juvenile system would make intervention harder. So that would be tough. But if diversion was the principal focus of the juvenile reform, proof beyond a reasonable doubt and defense lawyers wouldn't make that harder, because that's already been achieved. That's the distinction. Now the question is, what is the effect of all those reforms and the argument that Chapter 5 was making is that what you should really see after Galt and after Winship is a test. Of the dominant rationale of juvenile system, because if it's diversion, the juvenile system shouldn't be threatened or challenged. People should be just as happy with it as they were before Galt and before Winship. Because diversion is still going on. And guess what? If what you're talking about is how many places worried about the juvenile system, wanted to replace it or to cut it back, that didn't happen. there were still an awful lot of arguments that you should toughen up the juvenile court, just as there were before. But nobody wanted to abolish it. And the argument, as far as it was made last time, is that that should be some indication that diversion as a primary motive for the creation of the juvenile justice system was consistent with nobody trying to eliminate it, even when convicting kids got tougher, because they had lawyers, because the burden of proof was increased. Now, we come to the unfinished business in thinking about diversion as a primary mechanism for juvenile justice. And that is, if that's how you're going to judge the system, how good has it been at keeping kids out of the trouble that the criminal system would have gotten them into, we come to the very interesting and statistically difficult issue of how do you measure a negative? If the question is, how good has the modern juvenile court been at keeping kids out of trouble, what does the data tell us? Well, the data, quote unquote, is that one great big set of bar charts. This in chapter 5, in figure 5-2, and all those numbers. And you'll remember it was a bar chart that starts us off with two different systems . The criminal court and its incarceration rate in 1971 for young adults, that's kids between the ages of 18 and 24, just old enough so we know they weren't going to juvenile court either before or after 1971. Either before or after Galt and Winship and McIver and all the changes in the juvenile system. So the people in the criminal system, but young, are sort of the control group. Those are the kids that were never in the juvenile court before or after Galt. They were in the criminal court. But it's not really a control group, because they are getting a different treatment. The treatment they're getting, which changes over time, is what the criminal justice system is reserving for its youngest subjects. And boy, does that change over time. If the incarceration rate for that youngest group of criminal system participants was 100 in 1971, what chapter 5 tells you is that the incarceration rate for the kids in the criminal system, the youngest kids, went from 100 to 216 in the 20 years between 1971 and 1991. So criminal policy was changing and toughening very substantially. But that, of course, is the criminal justice system. What on earth does that have to do with how we're going to judge the juvenile system? Stick with me for a while. Between 1971, when that rate was 100, because that's where we started it, and 1991, when that rate more than doubles, what happened in the juvenile system? Well, it's a good news and bad news joke if you're a kid in the juvenile system. The good news is that the incarceration rate between 1971 and 1991 doesn't go up as fast as the incarceration rate for kids in the criminal system. If the juvenile incarceration rate was 100 in 1971, in 1991, it had increased. It did get tougher, but it went from 100 to 121. So if what you're doing is comparing the juvenile court in 1991 to the juvenile court in 1971, it's tougher. More kids are in detention, which is short-term confinement, or post-adjudicative confinement for a longer term. 21% more kids. So is the system better or worse in 1991 from a kid's perspective than it was in 1971? It's worse. A little bit worse. And not only that, but then Figure 5-2 takes you a little bit further. It takes you to 1995. And again, what you have is what's happening in the juvenile system and also what's happening to the youngest kids in the criminal system. Now, what's happening in the juvenile system in only 4 years, between 1991 and 1995, is things are getting very visibly tougher. In just 4 years, instead of the 20 years between the first two comparisons, the incarceration rate in the juvenile system goes from 121% of its 1971 level to 141%. So it's up another 20% from the 1971 base. Is that just as bad as the comparison from 1991 to 1971? Uh-uh. Don't let the figure con you. That's not as bad, because now we're talking about a 4-year trend, not a 20-year trend. That's a lot worse. Between 1991 and 95, you get the incarceration rate going from 121 to 141. That's 20% in 4 years, or 5% worse each year. Now, what was the 21% change between 71 and 91 per year? You do not have to be a physics major to do that math. That's 1% a year. So the toughening up is 4 times as great in that second era. Or, come on now, let's all learn to speak Zimring. If we're speaking Zimring about the primary policy emphasis of the juvenile justice system, kids are losing diversionary impact at a greater rate in the 1990s than before. Or are they? Now, whatever else you're going to get out of this course, you're going to know more old, very bad jokes at the end of a mere 15 weeks in this semester than you ever knew before. And one of them that you're going to hear over and over again is the Henny Youngman line, where somebody comes up to the stand-up comedian and says, "How's your wife?" And the comedian says, "What?" He says, "Compared to what? How's your wife compared to what? How's the juvenile justice system compared to what?" And the point of figure 5-2 is that if you compare the performance of the juvenile justice system to the performance of the criminal justice system for its youngest offenders, that last period, 1991 to 1995, when the absolute performance of the juvenile system is at its worst, it goes from 121 to 141. Meanwhile, for kids who are 18 to 24, in 20 years, the criminal justice system essentially doubled in its severity. Went from 100 to 216. What happened in the 4 years between 91 and 95? What happened is it went from 216 to 275. So the juvenile system goes from 121 to 141, things are bad. The criminal system for young offenders goes from 216 to 275. And at the end of that 4-year period, what has happened is that the difference between the criminal system and the juvenile system for the two groups that are closest in age it's not that they're coming together, it is that the contrast has gotten worse. In 1991, the difference between the criminal and the juvenile system was that the juvenile system, the criminal system had gone up, or the juvenile system had restrained growth by about 94%, 216 minus 121 is 94. What's the difference in 1995? That's 275 minus 141 How much tougher is the criminal system in 1995 than it was in 1971? It's 134% tougher. It was 94% tougher in 1991. So now we get to the bad joke again. The bad joke is, by one very plausible measure, even though the juvenile court, in its incarceration policy, lost more ground in the last 4 years of this comparison than ever before, when you compare it to what was going on with young adults, this was diversion's finest hour. Because the difference, remember what that judge was talking about in that first paragraph of that idiotic book he writes, The History of the Juvenile Court, that he writes 4 years after the juvenile court's been invented, or five. He says, the major policy objective of the juvenile court was to stop those kids from suffering from what would have happened to them in criminal court. The best measure we've got of what would have happened to kids who were 14 to 17 if they'd gone to the criminal court is what happened to the kids in the youngest group that did go to criminal court, 18 to 24. And what happened there was a jump from 100 to 275 in incarceration rate. And what happened over the period after 1991 was a jump from 216% of the base rate to 275%. And by that standard, the net diversionary impact of the difference between juvenile court and criminal court incarceration rates for the oldest group in the juvenile court and the youngest group in the criminal court, that gap, that diversion impact got greater. Now, in a funny sense, that's sort of ridiculous. The kids are locked up, so why should they feel good when the rate at which they got been locking up has been going up 4% a year in the juvenile court from 121 to 141? Compared to what? Because the crackdown in the criminal court was at its most extraordinary ever in terms of its relative growth. And by that measure, the greatest success that the juvenile court was on a comparative basis, achieving as a diversion was during the period when the crackdown on young offenders in the criminal court was at its most extreme. So if you were going to take, we think, the largest contrast you could find between juvenile and criminal courts ever in the first century, that both systems existed side by side, was probably at the very end of that century, in the 1990s, when the crackdown was most extreme. Okay, so much for the new math of Professor Zimri. What is the difference in policy between somebody who is a big fan of juvenile justice for diversion and a big fan of juvenile justice for intervention? Well, the people who like diversion, and by now, do you have a strong feeling that I'm one of them? Are they optimists or are they pessimists? Answer, both. But in an interesting pattern, and one that contrasts, I think, and you can discuss this in your discussion section, in an interesting fashion with the people who support strong degrees of intervention. The folks who like diversion is a rationale for people who are pessimistic about the capacity of courts and government officials to change kids' lives. Diversion is a passive virtue. Don't get in the way. Don't lock them up. Don't screw up. I'm from the government and I'm here to help you is one of the world's three biggest lies in the diversion ideology. And we are talking ideologies and articles of faith in both cases. The diversion advocate is pessimistic about the capacity of government to make things better, but optimistic about the capacity of kids to grow out of patterns of crime and delinquency. The mantra of diversion is the best known cure for youth crime is growing up. Let nature take its course. So the diversionist is an optimist about kids and a pessimist about government. The interventionist is an optimist about government and a pessimist about kids. Now, I know I'm a diversionist. Am I faking it a little bit? Why do you get the notion, Zimring, that the interventionist is a pessimist about kids? Because the very need for intervention is based on the notion that without some program, what's going to happen to the kids is bad news. Leave them alone and they're in trouble. Intervene with a program and they'll be in better shape. So the optimism there is about the impact of programs. The pessimism is about what happens without it. Okay. Those are the ideologies. The argument of the chapter, and since the same idiot that wrote the chapter is going to write your midterm and final, it would be good to get it right. The argument of the chapter is that the relative triumph of juvenile justice in the last 25 years was to create some haven for kids against the most enormous crackdown, using incarcerative sanctions in the criminal justice system that any democracy had ever experienced. To call what went on in the criminal justice system after 1971 the control group is a joke, because there was more dynamic and more change in policy toward criminals than there was in the juvenile system or in any other system in the United States. When the history of government policies over the last generation is written, the capital letters are not going to belong to things like In re Galt and Winship and MacIver, because the system that was changing big time was not the juvenile system. It was toughening up somewhat, but it was the criminal system. And that is an awfully important context in which to see and to judge relatively what's been going on in the juvenile system. In absolute terms, juvenile systems got tougher in the United States over the generation after the mid-1970s. That is undeniable. But in relative terms, they became, it was, I think, by comparison with what happened in criminal justice, diversion's finest hour. And that's not an accident. When you need diversion and sentiments of difference between juvenile and criminal justice the most is not during a period of era of good feeling or a period when rehabilitation is at its epoch, in the dominant ideology of criminal justice. It is when criminal justice is at its toughest and its most uncompromising that you would expect the distinctions, the statistical and ideological differences between juvenile and criminal justice to be the greatest. And that, in an odd sense, is also an explanation for the enormous political attack on the softness of juvenile justice that occurred in the 1990s. The reason that the attacks took place in the 1990s was because that was the contrast at its maximum. The people who were not playing ball with the dominant ideological changes going on in the rest of the control system were in juvenile justice. As much tougher as they were getting, the distinction between what they were doing, and this is why figure 5-2 is of importance, the distinction between the priorities in juvenile justice and in criminal justice was at its all-time high in the late 1990s because of the epic toughening of the criminal system. It had affected juvenile justice, but it had affected that much less than it had affected everything else. Okay, we'll get back to that. That's one of the things that was going on in the country. That's something which affects the current operations of juvenile justice and likely changes that are going to occur in it. But for now, we've had our dance with intervention and diversion and with those broad themes. Now for police. Police are involved in two very significant systems for the social control of adolescents. And since you are all recently retired adolescents, I am telling you things that in an experiential way, lots of you already know. What are the two systems in which police are enormously important for the social control of juveniles? Number one, and statistically the least significant of the two, is that police are, for the vast majority of cases that get to the juvenile justice process, they are the front end of formal juvenile justice in the United States and in every other developed country. If you're going to get involved in the juvenile court, step one is get yourself arrested. The cops are on the street, and they're the beginning of the formal system. And so you notice there was that one word that was the same in juvenile and criminal justice, arrest. My gosh, they even call it the same thing, where it's the beginning of the juvenile system. And the reason they call it the same thing is that the people who invented the court didn't get to reinvent the concept of arrest. They didn't own arrest. Police own arrest. And so the beginning of the formal juvenile justice system is police. Before there's intake screening, before there's adjudication of delinquency, there is either going to be an arrest or the process doesn't start. Are there some exceptions? Yes. Where parents make a complaint, and increasingly where schools do, because there is now some overlap between the formal public educational system and the juvenile justice system. But for the most part, the front end of the juvenile court is 1.5 million formal arrests of kids under 18 a year in this country. 1.5 million. And what
What did I say?
I said that's one of two systems, and that's the smaller system. Well, what's the big system? If this is the one that's at the front end of 99% of all the delinquency situations. For every one time that somebody in this room as a juvenile was involved in a formal process of arrest and intake screening in a juvenile court, there were probably between 30 and 50 times that somebody in this room as a juvenile was involved in some relationship with the police. Am I lying? You're the expert. How many police contacts do we have in the room now? There are about 50 or 60 people in the room. My guess is that there are a maximum of two or three formal juvenile court contacts, and there are 50 or 60 or 100 significant contacts with police. Again, maybe we can go back and take another self-report. And the reason for that is that the police are on their own an enormously important and virtually self-contained social and legal control system. For every once that the police at the start of the juvenile system, they are in the order maintenance business on their own in communities, much more importantly. You folks have been at Berkeley now for more than a month. You've been on Telegraph Avenue. Any police on Telegraph Avenue?
Yep.
Frequently. What are they doing there? Arresting people and making sure that they go into the criminal justice system and the juvenile system? No, not really. What are the police doing on Telegraph Avenue? Helping to maintain order. Why are they there? Well, there are a couple of reasons. One of them is that to a certain extent, police are assigned by police executives to go where they think problems are going to be. So police patrol. Where do police patrol? Where the police department thinks they're going to be needed. That's one reason police are there. Then there's another one. Police answer calls for assistance, and they try and resolve disputes. How does that happen on Telegraph Avenue? I've got it. A lot of kids call the cops. Kids don't like to call. Kids think the cops are the enemy. So who calls the cops? What kind of adults? All kinds of adults? That's almost paranoid. If you're running a store on Telegraph Avenue, why would you call a police officer? to what? Now, how do you disturb a business if you're a kid? Or become one? Let's talk for a moment. In the good old days when music wasn't something that you bought on the internet, where would you buy it? Music stores. You all remember music stores? They've mostly gone bankrupt. That's where you'd buy it. And in the years before Napster, that's where you'd steal it, too. Who would steal music? Kids? Oh, you jest. Sure. What are they stealing now? I don't know how much shoplifting goes on at head shops. But I will make you one guarantee. What's a head shop? Now I feel not nearly old, but aged. Would somebody tell us what a head shop is? I'll forgive you. I won't tell them. Yeah, both. And there is an incredible overlap between customers and predators for all shoplifting cases. This is also true. Let's take another example. Who steals lipstick? I don't. For a very simple reason. I don't have a good shade. The same people steal it as buy it, and particularly at the younger end. And that's one of the things that people who have retail businesses are going to make clearly known to police on Telegraph Avenue. That's not the only reason, however, that kids are a problem on Telegraph Avenue. Another reason is they block the streets. They think they own them. You may have noticed. Some of the shopkeepers have. What do police have to do with order maintenance? They own it. Who else do you call? If you don't call the police in any of these situations where you think you found somebody who stole them, where somebody is having an argument with you and you would like some authoritative person to end that argument, who else do you call? Whom else? Do you call? Now, so far, we're not talking 911 stuff. Not life or death. You got that, you call the police too, or an ambulance. But order, maintenance, power, and control is the business of street policing. And this is one of the reasons you were assigned two articles to read. One of them is a statistical study. Black and Reef. Of who gets arrested and what they get arrested for, how they get arrested. And the other is an essay by Egon Bittner that is 35 years old. It was published in 1976, but it was written in 1974. And there is one gosh, I think I think it's on page 83 in your book, and it's where Bittner makes a distinction. He says, after he's given a whole series of situations in which cops and kids interact problematically for the cops, he says it is not that kids, and he uses a contingency, may be trouble. As far as the police are concerned, kids are trouble. Their very existence is a management issue for policing. Now, there was at least one student I talked to who said he wanted to go into law enforcement. It's a perfectly wonderful way to make a living. There are very few jobs that are hiring now. Lawyers are having a very difficult time. They dress up in fancy suits and ties, but there aren't a lot of jobs right now. Guess what? For those communities that can still afford to pay civil servants, there are jobs as cops. In traditional police organizations, the people that I'm talking about, the cops that you call, are not juvenile specialists. They're ordinary street police. I doubt whether 1% of all police employees in the United States are juvenile specialists. But a pretty big hunk of all the business that street police do involves interactions with kids. I don't even think Berkeley has Telegraph Avenue specialists in the police training. That's what street police do. And that is the sort of stuff, except for the fact that both of the articles that you're assigned, one of them's 40 years old and the other is 35 years old. That wasn't an oversight. There are a lot of good modern studies, or you'd be reading them too. You got two sociological analyses. One is empirical. The other is interpretive. Black and Reese report a situation where trained observers watch cops in relatively low-class urban neighborhoods in three cities. Now, you should be a little bit suspicious because it's very difficult to watch cops without the cops knowing you're watching. So what happens there, and I'll use a little bit of social science lingo here, this is a Hawthorne effect. Many years ago, in a study of worker productivity in the Western Electric plant in Hawthorne, you put the observers in, and they were watching the people work with the phones, but the people who they were watching knew they were being watched. And the Hawthorne effect was the effect on the workers of being observed. Fewer people pick their nose when they know they're being watched. Fewer people take two-hour lunch breaks when somebody is studying how long they're working. So this became known as the Hawthorne effect. And very recently, because the study was done almost 90 years ago, but very recently there have been a whole series of studies suggesting that the Hawthorne effect may have been a myth and was certainly greatly exaggerated. But the point I'm making about Black and Rees is that these were not invisible observers. So what they were observing was most likely the police as the police wanted to be seen, because they knew they were being seen. That doesn't mean necessarily that they were wonderfully well behaved, but it does mean that all other things being equal, you're not going to have utterly unjustified shootings. Okay. In the 1970 publication, the cops know they're being watched. There are some, but not a ton, of black-white differences. African-American kids do get, for every 100 police contacts, they get arrested more often than the white kids. But Black and Rees tell you that this is because the citizens are asking the cops to arrest more with black kids. Question: is that therefore neutrally principled, or is that a different kind of racism? We're not sure from what Black and Rees tell us . But one indication of whether that is just a racial effect or a real difference is what color were the complainants who were asking. Remember, this is an old study. But if the difference occurs because more white complainants ask the police to arrest black kids, then I'm worried. I think that is a racial effect, but it's a racial effect that mirrors the community's prejudice. When white people call the police and it's white kids, they say, just hassle the kids, don't make any arrests. When the same white people call the police and it's black kids, they're saying, no, we want you to make an arrest. You can't blame the officer for the racial effect there. But I think you could make an argument under those circumstances that what's going on is racial in a problematic way, is prejudice. But it's community prejudice. But what if the people who are asking the officers to arrest the black kids more often are black complainants? Then it is vastly less likely that it's obvious prejudice. it is still very much to the systematic disadvantage of the black kids, but it's a more complicated dynamic. Which was it? We don't know. Something that you would have hoped would be in some of the tables, but wasn't. Now, the Black and Reese report of this study reports one very peculiar effect and one very predictable effect. What Black and Reese find is that reactions on the part of the kids to the cops has some predictive value in determining whether or not the cops make an arrest. One part of that is very easy to predict, and we're going to come back to that. Antagonistic kids are more apt to get arrested. It's a pretty modest increase, actually, in the Black and Reese, but I think it's real. Later on, I'm going to call it the offense of unlawful use of the mouth. Whatever else the interaction of kid and cop is, it's a power conflict. And the more antagonistic the kid, the more likely the kid is probably going to have a ride downtown, either for a formal arrest or just to get hassled. So that makes sense. But you may have noticed that there was another end to it that seems utterly peculiar. And that is that deferential kid, the real step and fetch it types, yes, sir, whatever you say, sir, they get arrested more often than the sort of middle pattern kid. That one is peculiar, but it is also not statistically significant. If you were to have one less deferential kid arrested, you would have no evident difference. So I don't think it's worth putting major emphasis on it, and it's not something that other studies find. It's a slightly higher rate, but it's a total of 4 kids who are deferential who get arrested. And if 3 kids who were deferential got arrested, it wouldn't be an apparent pattern. Is there any potential explanation for it? Could it be real? Yes, it could, because the kids who are deferential might be self-selected. If you know you've got dope on you, you might be in a mood to be extremely polite. And maybe suspicious cops know that. That's a lot of maybe. I think that's good thinking. I don't think there's any empirical evidence. Okay. Police juvenile contacts are mostly what the cops initiate because they're on patrol, or they're initiated by citizens. Most of them don't produce an arrest, only 15% in the Black and Reese study. This is all enormously discretionary. And we're going to be talking about rule versus discretion a lot on Wednesday. Bittner's approach in the essay is socially determined and regulatory. As far as Bittner is concerned, arrests happen. But the larger context in which he sees cops and kids interacting is one in which cops are involved in situation management. It's a hassle for a cop to arrest a kid. You got to fill out forms. Mostly what the police are doing are managing situations and potential conflicts. And the officer needs to resolve a citizen-generated demand or to maintain his own sense of control. And it is in that sense that on 84, Bittner says it isn't that cops, that kids may be trouble for cops. Kids are trouble in a situation management situation. Both of the articles show the extremely low importance and the low legal stakes in most incidents that involve the interaction of kids. Bittner flat out says something that I think is true, but this is again something that you, in terms of your own experience, might want to discuss. And that is that as far as most cops are concerned, the situation management of kids is a very low status part of policing. Cop comes home, and his significant other, his partner, says, "How was your day?" And the cop doesn't say, "Oh, it was interesting. And interestingly enough, I had this hassle with three kids." It's going to be low on the list. Policing juveniles is not a high-status part of policing in 1976 or in 2009. But the puzzle that I want you to think about between now and Wednesday's lecture is that with regard to probation officers, working in the juvenile court is a high-status entity. They like dealing with kids. People are more likely to want to choose juvenile probation than adult probation if they go into the career. Why the status difference? And what does it tell you about, on the one hand, policing, and on the other hand, probation work? That's where we will start on Wednesday. For reading, just review Bittner, review Black and Reese, bring your minds, and our large emphasis is going to be on rule versus discretion as a normative preference in police work. Do you want it to be governed by rules, or do you want it to be governed by police discretion?